Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, June 12th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford. We'll check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House. The Cape region is creeping toward some new kind of summer in the midst of the pandemic. Monday this week saw the beginning of the state's Phase 2 reopening, with many non-essential businesses and restaurants allowed to start up under restrictive guidelines. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us to talk about what the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force has to say this week. Hi, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
Jeanette, we heard some indications that some traditional summer tourist benchmarks are showing signs of life. Tell us about this.
Yes. So Christy Senatori, who's director of the Cape Cod Commission, released some traffic data on Thursday. And as you may have just heard at the newscast at the top of the hour, bridge traffic in May was a little closer to normal than it was in April. So in April, when it was sort of the height of the stay-at-home period, the traffic on the bridge coming onto the Cape, and I think both ways actually, was almost half of normal. And in May, it was 31%. And for the first weekend in June, it was only down by 10% compared to normal. You're looking at people coming back, it seems like. And yeah.
And not just traffic. We also got some
hotel stays.
Yeah. Not just traffic. We also got some hotel numbers. Right.
Right. So Wendy Northcross, who's director of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, says that she's been talking mostly anecdotally so far, but they are going to be putting out some numbers later about what hotels and other lodging establishments are reporting for their bookings. And she says that right away, when the governor announced phase two to be starting on time, the hotels noticed more increased web traffic and thousands of nights of lodging, she says, have been booked already. And she also said she was encouraged that it's families with kids as well. So people do feel comfortable planning their vacation.
Now, the task force also was involved in the release of a local business survey to try to get a sense of where businesses are at amid all of this. Tell us what we heard from that.
Yes. So about 350 businesses responded to this survey, representing all 15 towns on Cape Cod. And 75% of them said they definitely anticipate reopening if they were closed during the pandemic. 20% are unsure what they're going to do. And more than 5% of those who were closed said they do not plan to reopen. So certainly that's concerning. Yeah.
Let me jump in and ask you about another story you reported on this week. The state sent a message to school districts that seemed to suggest any schooling starting in the fall may have classrooms restricted to 10 students each. That caused plenty of concern and kind of head scratching from school districts, but the state kind of quickly followed it up with another message that seemed to back off on that. Tell us what happened here.
Sent out a memo to school districts, and really the main focus of the memo was to let them know how much PPE, how many masks and things like that, they should buy for the fall, considering that they're saying students are going to be wearing masks and the nurses are going to have extras and things like that. But sort of buried down on the bottom of page two, it said, here are some of the things that at this time you'll need for the fall. And then again, it says, at this time, classrooms can only have 10 students and two staff for a total of 12 people. But now the state is saying, well, we mean it is as of this moment, and within a couple of weeks, we're going to have updated guidelines. Someone told me all that 10 student thing is the guidelines for summer school. So you know, at this moment, that's what the research shows you should have, but they might change their minds or update it within a few weeks. And it's, of course, it's a big deal. If class is to 10 students, it's really going to be a difficult thing to accomplish for a district.
That is WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joining us. Thank you, Jeanette.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Rallies, marches, and protests continued this week, recognizing the death of George Floyd at the hands of police and demanding racial justice and reforms. WCAI's Eve Zukoff has been reporting from these events, and she joins us now to talk about how this week was different. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, you covered a protest in Woods Hole on Wednesday that was organized by scientists. Tell us, how did that come about?
Yeah, so this is actually part of a national day of protests for scientists and academics to, as they say, you know, take a pause, shut down their labs, and actually reflect on racism in science, engineering, academia, at the institutional level, at the most systemic level, but also individually in their own groups. And here in Woods Hole, scientists at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution picked up that mantle, but more than 300 people, many of whom scientists, but many of whom not, all came out to march with signs decrying police brutality, the killing of George Floyd, which sparked all of these protests, and also some hyper-specific science signs.
What's a hyper-specific science sign? What kinds of things do they say?
You know, they were calling out the cell line of Henrietta Lacks, a Black woman whose cells have been used to make all kinds of scientific breakthroughs, but they were used without her consent. And it's a really big shame in the scientific community, and there were people kind of calling for justice for Henrietta Lacks, you know, and even just on one side of a sign, it said science, the other side, it said justice. So, you know, it was higher brow to the more general. But it was there.
How else has the messaging in these protests evolved? Now, you've been to a number of them over the last couple of weeks.
That's right. And first, I should say a lot has stayed the same. You know, George Floyd is very much present, if you will, at these rallies. People are chanting literally justice for George. But there's greater demand now, I think, for political action. In Hyannis, that was the main message, really go vote. One organizer said, you know, people asked her why she was still protesting because the officers in Floyd's case have been charged. And she was like, no, wait a minute. We're fighting to change laws. So there are just deeper and longer lasting political and cultural demands that are really starting to shape out in these protests, even in a place like Cape Cod, where, you know, a lot of people have expressed satisfaction at these rallies for the police. There's something, for local police at least, but there's something deeper here that they're calling for.
Okay, switching gears here briefly, you also reported this week that some parents and educators are really unhappy with the state's guidelines to reopen daycares and preschools. Explain, what are the main concerns here?
Yeah, so the requirements include things like face masks for everyone who's age 2 and up, smaller class sizes, social distancing among children, really keeping them 6 feet apart, no hugging, no plush toys, no Play-Doh, no toys that are really hard to clean. And I talked to a daycare owner who just said, first of all, socially distancing toddlers is pretty much impossible. And it's really about having the time, money, and resources to actually do that, to create the individual play packets. That works takes so much time when you already have so many more demands on your staff's time to clean things. And her biggest concern, and the biggest concern of most people, is that enrollment and limiting class sizes, cutting those things could really destroy privately owned daycares and leave working parents and guardians without affordable childcare. It's, you know, the income loss, it's the new regulations, not getting teachers back that you had before. When you put those things together, the businesses, they say, are going to be crippled and they're not going to make it. Though, of course, the state and Baker administration have maintained that these are implementable guidelines and they are created with the health and safety of children and staff really at the forefront.
And right now, these daycares are going through the process of presenting applications to the state that demonstrate they can meet these guidelines, and then they would be able, if they do and get signed off on by the state, they'd be able to reopen at a certain date at the end of June. Is that right?
That sounds right, yeah. And already there seems to be a real appetite for that. As of this morning, 35,000 signatures have been added to an online petition criticizing the guidelines and asking for revisions.
WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. The Mashpee Wampanoag tribe received some good news last Friday evening. A federal judge sided with the tribe in a suit against the Department of the Interior. With us to talk about that story is WCAI Sam Houghton. Sam, you've characterized this as a momentous shift in the tribe's pursuit to protect their land in Mashpee and Taunton. Tell us, what was the judge's ruling here?
Yeah, so in the lawsuit, the tribe was trying to stop the Department of the Interior from taking away their reservation. In order for Native Americans to have their land placed in trust, they have to prove that they are, you know, basically recognized by the federal government before 1934. That's when Congress passed a bill aimed at helping tribes. So the Interior Department under the Trump administration was arguing that the Mashpee Wampanoag just did not meet that standard. But Judge Paul Friedman on Friday said the government's argument not only had serious legal problems, it was an abuse of discretion. That was his wording. So he ordered the department to resubmit a new ruling. And leaders in Mashpee are optimistic that order was strong enough that the Trump administration won't have a choice but to issue a new favorable ruling. Basically, they're saying that the Interior Department will have to argue that the tribe should have their land held in trust.
So what does this mean for the tribe now going forward? Is this it? Is their reservation protected now?
So in the short run, yes. But if you've been following the Mashpee tribe, you'll know this. There's likely to be a lot more to come. I talked with Jessie Baird this week. She's the vice chairman of the tribe. And one thing she said to me was, you know, in Indian country, you can never say the war is won, but this is certainly a victory. There's also another storyline here that I spoke with Baird about, and that's the executive branch of the country. She said the Interior Department under the Trump administration has really gone out of its way to harm the tribe. And she says that they should be held accountable. Since the administration went after the tribe's land, and while they may have gotten a favorable ruling, they've had to lay off staff, projects have stalled, and they've incurred a lot of legal bills. So I think the headline here is the tribe's reservation is protected for now, but the next few months will be telling. Baird is hopeful, even confident, there's going to be a change in administration come November, which he says will be good news for the tribe. Joe Biden has publicly recognized and supported the Mashpee tribe. So I think we'll see.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks a lot for that.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. A new survey of businesses on Martha's Vineyard tells a grim story about the pandemic's impact. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us with that story. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, tell us about the survey and who responded.
So the survey was conducted by the Martha's Vineyard Commission, which is a regional planning body on the island, during, I believe it was the first 2 weeks of May. And there were almost 200 respondents, which is a huge number, just relative to the number of businesses on the island. And they pretty much range from everyone, including, you know, regular business enterprises that had between 10 to 50 people to sole proprietors. And they included year-round and seasonal businesses as well.
I was looking through this article here. I was surprised at how it seemed that businesses were pretty well informed about the programs that the government had put in place to try to support them through this time.
Right. Right. I thought that was interesting, too. You know, more than half of the people who responded said that they had already applied or they planned to apply for federal money. 64% said they were completely aware of the grant funding or had sought out a financial advisor. But, you know, the interesting thing is that despite the federal grant money being available and a lot of them, I think, utilizing payroll protection loans, pretty much no one was untouched by the pandemic. And most of the businesses felt that they were not enough to, I think, get through this. For a lot of them, which, you know, kind of it's unfortunate, but it was interesting to hear no, because you hear about the loan and you're like, oh, great. But then you don't really know or follow up what comes after.
One of the other things that that seemed to come out of the survey with business owners on the island is that their sense of how important testing is going to be to helping them get open. And that's kind of interesting, too, because they're kind of making a leap between what testing means to the public and what that means for their business in the end.
Right. I think there were at least, you know, three or four respondents that just said testing, testing, testing when they were asked, you know, if you could get the ear of your federal of your state legislator, what would you tell them was most important? And that's actually been a big initiative on the island. We right now have two testing sites, one at the hospital that will test symptomatic patients, one that tests asymptomatic patients. And so that looks like that's something that's on its way, but it's not quite there yet, I think, to where businesses feel really solid about it. Just to sort of go over some of the striking statistics here, just from the survey alone, 71% of businesses said that the pandemic would have a severe negative impact on their business. 37%, which is, you know, that's a third of businesses said they would have to close in 3 months if the situation didn't improve, and 50% said that they were already closed because of it. Now, the survey happened in early May, so things would have changed since then, but it still just shows you kind of and paints a really sort of dire picture of the economic landscape here.
Yes. Part of that testing component was the sense of trying to create a sense of confidence
right.
in the community, right? So that people feel like,
yeah,
if there's
exactly.
enough testing, we can go out to stores and feel confident that the virus isn't lurking here somewhere. We can go out to restaurants. But like you say, with the
right.
responses to this, reading through them, it's just anguishing. You get a sense of the heartache for many of these people who have put so much of themselves into their businesses and are caught in this moment.
Totally.
The path forward isn't even clear. Yeah.
No, and you read people's responses, and it's like, I put my blood, sweat, and tears in this for 10 years, and it might just have to close. And, you know, someone when asked what they would tell their legislator, it was like, I wouldn't even know where to begin. It's also heartbreaking. And so you can tell people, even if there's sort of hope, a lot of businesses said that they were going to open here in 3 months, which means, you know, they're going to open for the summer regardless. There's still this sort of ominousness, if that's even a word, about what the future holds for them. And I think a lot are really scared.
That is Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette joining us with this story. Noah, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Steve.
In Orleans, it is official. Sipson Island will be preserved for public access in perpetuity. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle with the story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, we've talked about this in the past. Sipson Island has been privately owned since the early 1700s. Its preservation represents a lot of people coming together and working real hard, and the deal itself is unusual. This closed just on Monday, right? Tell us about this.
Right. It closed earlier this week, and it's really a cooperative arrangement between a new trust, the Sipson Island Trust, several conservation trusts from the surrounding towns on the bay, and the Nadler family, which owns most of the island, who really worked closely with Orleans officials to come up with this plan to purchase most of the island and set it aside as conservation land. As you said earlier this week, they finalized the $4.8 million purchase of six lots, which includes 22 of the 24 acres on the island. Two more lots will be acquired later for another $585,000. Eventually, the Nadler family will retain ownership of just 2 acres on the land on the island. So 22 of those 24 acres are going to be conservation land and will be public, open to the public. The entire island, however, will be protected in perpetuity with a conservation restriction. Mon Cochran, who's a director of the Friends of Pleasant Bay and the chairman of the fundraising effort for this, said in his lifetime, and he's lived in Orleans his entire life, this island has never been open to the public, and that's going to change as soon as this summer With this final purchase, the beaches on the island will be open to anyone who can reach them by boat. He said this is a real dramatic shift for the town and for people in the surrounding bay. Now, the upland portion of the island probably won't be open to the public because there are still some buildings there that will eventually be torn down. The trust has to raise another $150,000 to make that happen. And they're eventually going to also provide access to a dock on the northern end and a viewing platform on the southern end. Cochrane hopes he hopes those additional funds to acquire the final two lots can be raised by the end of the year. And everybody's just really thankful for this effort. This was really some of the last large open space parcels in Orleans, and certainly the biggest on Pleasant Bay. And ultimately, there's plan to have at least one of the existing buildings converted into an education facility with the Friends of Pleasant Bay and Pleasant Bay Boating cooperating to develop programs for the public and for local students.
Hey, Tim, real quickly, I want to ask you about another story you've got that Chatham has really a fun idea for its 4th of July parade. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, a lot of people obviously are disappointed that the parade was canceled this year because obviously the crowds are too big to guarantee social distancing. So the committee that runs the parade has decided that they're going to have a virtual parade. Anyone who might have otherwise participated in the parade or wants to help with this is invited to send a photo or a short video clip incorporating this year's parade theme, which still is Chatham Celebrates Women in honor of the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. What they're going to do is put all those together in a short video, and this will be shown on the town's cable channel, streamed on its website, and anyone who's interested in contributing to that can get more details on our website, CapeCodChronicle.com.
That is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
A popular gym and hangout in Eastham has been shut since even before the pandemic, but now it looks like it may be poised to reopen. From the Provincetown Independent, we've got Casey Myers with a look at that. Hi, Casey.
Hello. Yes, I'm talking about Willie's. We wrote about it in this week's Provincetown Independent, and there's a subsequent follow-up that just occurred Wednesday night. So anyway, yes, Willie's, which closed in December, has gone through a series of renovations, and it looks like it is about to reopen. There was a final inspection by the town's health and fire and building department scheduled for a couple of days ago on Wednesday, and we have not heard specifically from the town, but Barbara Niggle, the owner of the gym, sent an email out to all the members saying, welcome to the rebirth of Willie's. And then she listed 28 improvements that the gym has made and says that federal, state, and local codes have all been passed. Some of the ones that are important to mention here that have been redone is the new fire sprinkler system, a new fire panel, a new pool enclosure, emergency exits, and replaced sprinkler heads, and new heating and AC throughout. And I mention these in particular because they highlight some of the most egregious problems the gym has had over the past almost 20 years. Broken fire suppression system and the unpermitted after-hours party that happened when the sprinkler system was broken is what caused the town to shut Willie's down in the first place. I mentioned the exits because social media posts of that party showed the exercise equipment pushed up against the fire doors. People have complained for years about the heating and AC not working properly and the temperatures being really difficult to work out in the gym. So this is all pretty amazing. And what's unknown here is how Barbara Niggle has paid for all this. Her history of not paying employees and contractors is legendary. And we know that she borrowed $4.6 million from the hedge fund in 2019. And that note must be repaid in September of 2020.
Casey, for anybody who doesn't really know Willie's, maybe you better explain quickly why it's such an important part of the community life out there.
Yeah, it's an 87,000 square foot building. It's absolutely huge. And it's in Eastham. And it has everything. I mean, it's a real smorgasbord of everything you would ever want to have in a gathering place, including indoor, outdoor tennis courts, a gigantic pool, exercise rooms. It has conference center space. It has kind of a restaurant in the lobby. It's got pool tables. It's got a huge play area. It's, you name it, it's basically has it or has had it in the past.
It's got storage
and
space,
everybody
too.
Loves
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Well, it can't open anyway until the governor gets to the next phase of the reopening, right? The gym.
Phase three, which, right.
Gyms don't happen until then, yes.
Right, which is now looking like the end of June, right?
I don't think anybody wants to try to read Governor Baker's mind at this moment, but yes, maybe
yeah.
So.
Yep.
That is
yep.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
A letter signed by more than 70 artists and other people accuses the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center of a culture of racial discrimination. From the Cape Cod Times, Ethan Genter has this story. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Tell us more about this letter, who it's from, and what it says.
Yeah, so a group of former and current fellows at the Fine Arts Work Center had sent out this letter on Monday, and they kind of go through 13 points of kind of grievances they have with the Fine Arts Work Center. For people who don't know, the Fine Arts Work Center is kind of this very prestigious center up in Provincetown. It does kind of at the heart of it is this fellowship program that kind of runs for 7 months, so it's a lot longer than a lot of other residencies, and it's kind of a highly sought after kind of placement. So these former and current fellows put out this letter that basically says this kind of all happened in the wake of George Floyd in Minneapolis. After the center had put out kind of a statement about police brutality and murder and racism, they kind of said, these fellows, maybe you should look at home first before you kind of comment on these. We've kind of gone through and experienced years of racial problems, kind of interactions. Some examples there, they say there's kind of been poor relations between the fellows and neighbors, fellows and kind of the administration. Yeah, so there's a lot of to unpack in all of this.
So even though this was kind of triggered in some way by what's happening right now around the country with talks about racial justice, they're pointing to what they're saying has been kind of a long-standing culture there that's been marginalizing and disadvantage, putting people of color at a disadvantage when they're there. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the main points in this is they, artists of color, are saying that they are kind of brought in and kind of used as cultural capital for the center, but they are not given protection and kind of aren't treated the way that they should be treated in these programs. They're kind of saying this has been going on for years, some kind of failure to mediate between issues between neighbors. So yeah, it's kind of this apparently longstanding. And the center has said they're going to look inward. They're going to kind of go through a self-reflection period, but they have kind of denied that they're racist. I think they called the notion repugnant.
So the center put out a response yesterday and gave you a response at the Times, kind of a detailed response to this.
Yeah, and kind of in a backdrop to all of this is, so this fellowship ended in the end of April. Obviously, we're in the middle of a pandemic at kind of right around that time is when the pandemic started to really bubble up. So they were given an extension, the fellows, to stay at the center until June 15th. So that's coming up, Monday, right next week. So the center's kind of said they can stay until then, but they need to kind of leave. That's caused some other concerns. But the center has kind of acknowledged that, hey, we do notice we have some issues. We're working on it. That seems like not exactly what the fellows were pushing for. They want to have people on kind of better representation in the governmental structure of the center. And they also want kind of an apparatus to be able to protect Black and artists of color.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times joining us to talk about the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center. Ethan, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. In 2012, a Black 15-year-old New Bedford boy was shot and killed by police. The case is back in the news in the wake of protests against the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We have Jack Splane now from the Standard Times to update us on some recent developments around the case. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm well. Jack, the boy's name was Malcolm Gracia. An attorney for the family recently presented what he said was new evidence disputing some of the police version of events. Tell us a little bit about what he revealed here.
So he revealed some evidence that indicates that Malcolm Gracia may have been shot in the back as he was running away from police. Two of his wounds were to the back, one to the side. He revealed some evidence about the detective who was allegedly stabbed by Gracia. He revealed some evidence that the wound was not terribly deep. The city countermanded with some evidence that in the ambulance, Detective Barnes suffered a difficulty breathing, and they had to do some compressions to get him going. The long and short of it, Steve, is that in the settlement with the family, which was a $500,000 settlement in February, part of the agreement was that the plaintiff's attorney, the family's attorney, could bring out evidence that had been embargoed. It had been sealed by the courts while the civil case was going on. And that evidence has long resonated in the New Bedford minority community. Ever since the killing happened 8 years ago, the New Bedford NAACP and other elected city councilors who are Black have complained that that they're skeptical of the police narrative. The district attorney's office, then District Attorney Samuel Sutter, investigated it after the police investigated it and found that, in fact, Gracia did attempt to stab the officer and that the officers were acting in self-defense when they killed him. This case was also complicated by the fact that in the civil trial, the court found that it was a bad stop by New Bedford police. Police had stopped Gracia because they thought they saw him on a surveillance camera making a gang handshake, and they were not familiar with him and wanted to find out. They had a program at the time that was called Meet and Greet. Many in the city felt it was similar to New York's Stop and Frisk, and they wanted to find out what was going on with this kid. So they went up to him where he really hadn't done anything wrong at that point, and he had his hands in his pockets, and they said they felt threatened because in their experience, when a suspect has hands in their pockets, they may take out a weapon. And so they got into a scuffle and tragedy resulted. So it's been a case that has been back in the news because the Black Lives Matter protesters in New Bedford, and there have been a lot, I think we're at the 12th or 13th consecutive day, have called for the firing of the officers involved.
And what with the attorney making this presentation this week, what does the district attorney and the city say in response to that?
Well, it's a different district attorney now than then. And the new district attorney stands by the investigation, says it was a self-defense action. The city has said very little, but to say that the facts are already established and the investigation is done. The protesters did march to the mayor's house one evening and debated him. He told them that they don't know all the facts. They've responded, give us the facts, but they've also called for him to be voted out of office. The feelings on the issue are running very high in New Bedford right now.
And the protests are continuing, as you say.
They're continuing. They have dwindled. They toward the end of, I guess the beginning of this week, maybe the weekend, after 7 or 8 days, they began to be markedly smaller. Some of the activists have said that they intend to continue to be involved. They are trying to press this issue of the Gracier investigation being reopened. It can only be reopened by the governor at this point. That's what they are advocating for.
That is Jack Spillane from the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
A proposal to have Martha's Vineyard restaurants serve customers seated at Veterans Memorial Park throughout the summer has been withdrawn, but it certainly sparked some heated conversation. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times has the story. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, this idea came from the entrepreneur behind Beach Road Weekend, which is among the summer event casualties of the pandemic. Tell us about this idea for restaurants and where it seemed to go astray.
Yeah, so this was Adam Epstein, and he had this idea of putting the same place he does Beach Road Weekend, putting tables out there and surrounding them with these short white picket fences, you know, making them individual dining places. And he was going to solicit restaurants to serve dinners there. People would have to order ahead of time and their meals would be brought to them there. He was going to have bar service there. And he was putting up the upfront money and hoping to recoup some of that. He was going to give some of the proceeds, if there were proceeds at the end, to local charities. And the town would also benefit from this. It's a town park. It sort of came out on Friday. And by the time it actually got to the selectmen's agenda on Tuesday night, it was dead on arrival. And basically the backlash was that this park is where soccer games are held and baseball games are held and softball leagues. And people are hopeful that at some point those will return to action. And they say that the park is needed for that. And so having heard that, Adam decided ahead of the meeting to withdraw his proposal. It was an interesting idea. And there were people on both sides. There were a lot of people saying, cheering him on as this is an outside-the-box type of an idea that's needed right now. Vineyard Haven is behind all the other towns on the island at this point in helping its restaurants. Edgartown is going ahead with outdoor dining in parking lots and, other sidewalks and things like that. And Oak Bluffs is also talking about closing Circuit Ave for a day or two. But there's been no such proposal in Vineyard Haven at this point.
I want to ask you about another story that you have in the paper. The executive director of the Martha's Vineyard Museum is stepping down, even as the museum seemed to be hitting a high note in the past year. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is Phil Wallace. And anybody who knows Phil Wallace knows that he's a very gregarious guy and, a get-it-done kind of guy, and that's what he was brought in for. He really wasn't a museum guy, and he says that in the article. What they needed was someone to move the museum from Edgartown to Vineyard Haven to its new home and raise the money for that, which was $30 million, and he was able to do that and accomplish that, and it is a beautiful setting. Right now, though, like every place else, they're in this holding pattern, and that's a problem. And they need a manager who can bring the museum to the next level. And he admittedly says he's not that guy. He's not the museum guy. He's the guy who could get it to that point. So, they needed to cut some budget, and he's the highest paid person at the museum. So he thought it was the right time for him to step aside and be able to bring the museum to that next level when they're ultimately able to reopen again.
That is George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times joining us. Thanks, George.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
Beacon Hill leaders are responding to calls from protesters to address police brutality, accountability, and the makeup of police forces. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about some of the proposals state lawmakers are working on.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
House Speaker Robert DeLeo and the Black and Latino Caucus agreed, at least to what they say they're calling parameters for how they might write a police reform bill. What are they hoping to do?
Yeah, this is really moving pretty fast. I talked to DeLeo just the other day before he had this meeting, and he said that he was looking forward to it and had some ideas of what he wanted to go. And then really right after the meeting, they put out this joint statement where DeLeo really declared that he's going to go forward with this bill. One of the biggest parts of the DeLeo proposal is to establish an independent office to enforce policing standards, and perhaps more importantly, to maintain a certification for police officers. That means that if there is a violation of those standards or any kind of incident, that certification could be revoked by this new bureaucracy that could be put in place. It would also do more short-term fixes, like banning the use of chokeholds in the state. That's kind of seen as a short-term fix, whereas a lot of the institutional and systemic problems are seen as much more long-term. DeLeo's proposal would also have what they're calling an affirmative obligation for police officers to intervene when a fellow member of law enforcement is, you know, using force illegally or improperly. And it would also create a legislative commission to study civil service law for ways to improve minority recruitment of police. And what that means is that the tests and civil service obligations and recommendations that go into hiring for things like police officers would be rewritten. It could be something seen a little bit more of like an affirmative action type system to get more people of color onto these police forces and then into the higher ranks to manage those police forces. This is something that's been called for many years, and now with the national tone as it is, it seems like Beacon Hill is really trying to go much more forward on that.
Beacon Hill doesn't exactly have a reputation for acting fast, and there's not a lot of time left in this session. Do they think they can get this done fast?
They have to. They have until the end of July before their session ends. There's been no indication that they're going to lengthen the session because of the coronavirus crisis or anything like that. They're very far behind already on things like the budget and major legislation. So they are going to cram virtually everything that they need to do into the last weeks of June and the entire month of July before their recess. DeLeo spoke this week and said, you know, to me when I saw him, that he definitely wants to get it done before that, you know, July 30th. First deadline, but that means going through the Senate and arriving at a compromise that Governor Baker can sign. It's also important to remember that if Governor Baker were to veto something after that deadline, Democrats have no way to override him at a certain point. So they would have to pass something mid-July if it is something that the governor would object to. So there's a lot of work to be done to come up with a compromise.
What about in the Senate? Has Senate President Karen Spilka talked publicly about any efforts happening in that chamber?
The Senate is officially forming a task force to look at these types of issues and to work with the Black and Latino Caucus to deliver their own set of proposals. And Senator Cream actually has a bill out just this week with Representative Liz Miranda that would look at police reforms from a different perspective. And bills like that could inform the way the Senate is going to move. A task force could be a fast process. It could be a very slow one. It's the same deadline that they have of really having to do things in the next few weeks. Things are moving faster than normal Beacon Hill speeds, I should say, than they have been in the past on this particular issue, again, because of that kind of national outcry that we're seeing. So I would expect the Senate's task force to be a shorter one. However, they still got to sit down, they still got to compromise, and they still have to deliver something that Baker can sign.
What about the governor? He's made some remarks about some of his own proposals. Is it safe to say he's largely on the same page with the House and the Senate in getting something passed?
It's a very big page. Yes, they are all on the same side of this thing, but there's a lot there. Baker, his comments have been more about police transparency. He's also meeting with the Black and Latino Caucus and is expected to file his own set of proposals relatively soon. The one thing that we know he doesn't want to do is to defund the police, which is, you know, kind of the rallying cry of a lot of these protests. Baker told me this week that he does not endorse defunding the police and that he expects, local aid to be as robust as usual, given some federal help, but he does want to do something as far as police oversight and transparency. Whether or not that's exactly what the Democrats want to do remains to be seen.
And as you said, a lot of this is happening because of public pressure. But what about police unions? Have we heard from them, and would they be open to reform?
Police unions are extraordinarily powerful on Beacon Hill. They're one of the top lobbies, not only just because police themselves are very popular in their districts, it's that, you know, that these police organizations carry a lot of weight and a lot of donations to the elected officials. So politically, they are not to be trifled with. They haven't been too upfront on where they see reforms could happen or what they want to see. It's definitely going to be a roadblock, though, as far as, you know, the types of reforms to police union contracts and to the oversight that they go along with. I expect them to be vocal.
I want to switch gears to the pandemic. The governor signed a bill this week mandating that nursing care and other assisted living facilities report more data to the health department. But nearly as soon as he signed that bill, he said he would like to make some changes.
Yeah, it was kind of an example of COVID politics, where under normal circumstances, Baker probably would have vetoed a bill like this. But instead, he signed it, and then it immediately offered a new bill with remedies, which means that there's no guarantee that the legislature takes this up. One thing that he is maybe at odds with, especially with the House, is with senior housing. One thing that the House was adamant about doing was having senior housing facilities report infections and deaths and different kinds of COVID data daily to DPH. Baker says that that's an unreasonable expectation for, say, a landlord of a senior housing complex that doesn't have any kind of medical interaction with the residents there, don't have access to their medical records, wouldn't really have any idea who has COVID and who doesn't. So that's where they might butt heads with the House and the Senate on there. So we can expect maybe some deliberation over Baker's bill, or they could ignore it. Again, they'll have a very limited capacity to do anything by the time they have to recess. Well, they don't have to recess. By the time they will recess at the end of July. And this, you know, Baker's recommendations here after the fact might be left on the cutting room floor.
And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And that's WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean from the State House there. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from WCAI's Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, and Sam Houghton. We spoke with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent and Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times. Checked in with Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And Mike Dean there up at the State House speaking with Catherine Iden. A big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio for juggling the phone lines and texting me updates throughout the show. And to my family for keeping the ruckus to a minimum for the past hour, including my daughter who's been doing her yoga on tiptoes. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.